Video game addiction. Google it and you'll get 95 million results. Now, as parents of boys, video games are on all of our minds. But is addiction a thing? Find out when we talk to our guest at On Boys. But first, these messages. Jen and I know that life is super busy for all of our listeners, and so we have connected with Cozy. Cozy is an app that is going to allow you to sync up your schedules for the entire family. So imagine everybody's soccer practice and music lessons and movie night is all in the same app so everyone can keep track of everyone's schedules. Plus, Cozy also knows that meal planning can be a super stressful part of your week. So they have included within the app recipes and grocery lists for what you need. So you could stand in the middle of the grocery store, as I've done many times, and think, what am I going to have for dinner tonight? Open the Cozy app and there are suggestions and lists for you right there. Plus, your kids can add what they need for their lunches. All of those things can be inside the Cozy app. So check it out. You can download it for free. Cozy, C-O-Z-I. I wonder if you have subscribed to Jennifer's Building Boys Bulletin yet. You know, it is the email that I open every Monday morning because I know that she has curated the latest information about boys in the news, the latest studies about boys, and it's all in one place. So I can get smart really fast because of the work that she is doing behind the scenes. Building Boys Bulletin comes to you every week. It's a wealth of information. Go to buildingboys.net and click on the red subscription button. Also, have you visited my website? This is janetboysalive.com. You can opt in there for my free report on boys and big emotions, common mistakes we make as parents, and what to do instead. That's a free guide. Just go to boysalive.com. And now, let's hear more about video games and video game addiction from our guest expert. Thanks for joining us for On Boys.
This is On Boys Parenting Podcast. We are your hosts, Jennifer L.W. Fink and Janet Allison. Video game addiction. When I Google that term, I get 95 million results. And the first one is for an addiction treatment center. You all know that I am a mom of boys, so you might wonder why I even need to bother to Google that term. I mean, the symptoms of video game addiction seem pretty obvious. The kid who wants to do nothing but play video games, this obsessive desire to the exclusion of all else. And all of you also know that there are few topics that cause as much conflict between parents and children as, what is it, Janet?
Video games.
But I want to really dig in today. What I want to know is if video game addiction is really a thing, if that is a helpful way to think about obsessive desire to play video games, and more importantly, what we can and should do if we feel like our kids' gaming is out of control. Joining us today is Chris Ferguson. He is a professor of psychology at Stetson University and co-author of a book that I read some years ago that I still think about very often. The book is Moral Combat: Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong. And he is the father of a 17-year-old boy. This is our people. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thanks for having me on today. It's a real pleasure.
All right, let's just dig right in. Is video game addiction a thing?
Yeah, that's a big question. Well, I mean, first off, most of us don't like to use the word addiction because that sort of creates this comparison with substance abuse that really isn't accurate. You know, so there is a thing. So most of us usually use terms like pathological gaming or problematic gaming or something of that sort. So that kind of divorces us from the sort of idea that, like, because you see these headlines like video games are like heroin, right? You know, and right. that's not true. That's absolutely false. That's clear moral panic, as we call it, you know. So Kai would say, like, if that were true, then like the heroin addicts are doing addiction wrong, you know, because games are way cheaper than heroin is. So if you get the same effect for like Call of Duty, then you ought to just, you know, we ought to be giving people to opiate addictions like video games in order to transition them off. So obviously it's a very different set of phenomenon. And we kind of know this, but those headlines.
But you know what? Wait, I'm going to back you up a little bit. When you say we kind of know this, we in psychology research may kind of know this. I'm not really sure that a lot of parents, have really thought beyond, this is driving me crazy. And you see a headline about video game addiction. And I know parents who are worried that video games has the same pull and draw as drugs.
I think the message is popular with parents, but I think parents, I don't know, maybe I'm being optimistic here a little bit. I think most parents sort of still know it's not really true. We don't let our kids like hang out and say, well, I just wish my kid would cut down on heroin so that they could balance their heroin with their school use, you know, or something.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think, the message is popular because people want to demonize something they don't like. But if you really think a little bit more carefully, it's not like, well, I just wish my kid would use heroin on the weekends and not during the week or that sort of stuff. We know that there's a clear difference between these things, even if we don't want to admit it.
And that's true. Like in most cases, we don't buy our kids a syringe.
Yeah.
And hope they will recreationally use heroin, right? Like we do buy our kids gaming systems because we do see there's some value in it. There's some fun in it. There's some harmlessness in it, or we wouldn't do it at all.
Right. Yeah. It's not like, I really wish my kid wouldn't use heroin, but okay, I'll get them some heroin for Christmas because it's the holidays or something of that
right.
sort. You know? So there's clearly some sort of difference there. And, but on the other hand, we would recognize that, there are people, both adults and kids, who do overdo it with technology and not just games, but with a lot of attention on smartphones and other screens right now as well. But then it becomes this kind of question of, well, is it really the technology that's the problem, or is it something else that is going around? Because we know people overdo a lot of things, so some people overdo shopping, some people overdo sex, some people overdo food, some people overdo work.
Exercise can be overdone.
Exercise, some people overdo cats. You can Google cat hoarder and you'll see people who've been arrested because of the number of poorly cared for cats they have in there. And they keep doing it. So yes, that's clearly an addiction too. To use that colloquial term once again. But most of these things aren't diagnosable, or at least, there's no like cat addiction and like the DSM or the WHO's, compendium of diseases and stuff. So the question becomes, why are we so interested in video games and other forms of technology? And why don't we care that much about the work addicts and the exercise addicts and these other individuals? And is it really the technology that is the sort of culprit? Which is what a lot of people want to believe. So when people are like, yes, it's like heroin, that's what people are really saying. They want to think that it's the video games that's the culprit, that is really sort of the originating cause of the problems that the individual, again, we tend to focus on kids. So in this case, the kids are experiencing, when in fact, it may be more of a symptom. So I think that, again, there's not really disagreement that there are some individuals who overdo technology, but one of the big questions we have in the field, and there's disagreement, so not all scholars agree on this, is whether the technology is sort of the root, or at least one root cause of these problems. I think most people would agree that it's sort of complicated, it's not the only cause, but is it one root cause of the problem, or is it merely a symptom of other problems that are going on? So in other words, do you have a depressed child who is turning to video games as a kind of self-medicating, sort of thing? We might say, well, maybe that's not the best way of dealing with the depression. That may be true, but really the problem is the depression. That's what originated. And then, taking the games away wouldn't actually fix the depression. In fact, you may be taking away a coping mechanism from the kid that they are using in order to, you know, try to alleviate their negative mood. So there may be some, you know, danger a little bit in addressing the problem in the wrong way. So I think most people would not say, like, if your kid is experiencing their grades slipping or isn't sleeping or something of that sort because they're on technology continuously, yeah, that's a problem. But you may also need to be aware that that's probably a part of a larger constellation of problems that that child is experiencing. And the worst message for parents is that that constellation may include you. Parents may be part of the problem in a lot of these situations, which is why people like the heroin headlines is it also tends to absolve parents or other social structures entirely from any kind of originating, you know, element of the problem that the child may be experiencing.
It's a lot easier to think, let's get rid of the games, let's get rid of the PlayStation, no Xbox, I'm taking your phone away at this time, and all will be well.
It'd be a miracle. My child will go back to how they were when they were four. Obedient and respectful. I don't know any four-year-olds actually.
I'm like, I did not have a four-year-old that way, but who is that? Maybe you did.
So I really appreciate that you're bringing this around to what are the other factors going on in a boy's development. And there's also in a boy's development, there are times when they are, and also a boy's temperament, you know, he might be more outward, outgoing and active and out there, and then he might not be. And there's also a stage of development around age 12, 13, when boys get really heavy and they're just like, ugh, and they don't want to be outdoing and they don't want to be engaged with family, and they're much more social with friends if they're social at all, because some boys are not. And so I appreciate what you're saying of like video games can be the refuge for these boys that are struggling with their changing bodies and their changing social strata, and that that is a place that they can find comfort. And we think, oh, well, they're being social with their friends. But what we ultimately know is we do need to get them out of their bedrooms and we do need to get them out of the house. And then, you know, I'll just throw in here, we've had a pandemic, so that's changed everything as well. I think it's good to just kind of realign of what is normal development and normal social development, and then how video games enter in and become a crutch, also entertainment as well.
What could be a challenge? I mean, you know, and of course I'm the parent of a teenage son myself. So, you know, that's a common experience for parents, is that you have 12 years of one child and then suddenly you end up with a different child. You know, people have been complaining about this for eons. In fact, certain, you know, sets of behavior, and all of a sudden that changes. That's a fairly normative developmental process. They become more rebellious. They no longer see you as particularly intelligent. They may be outright irritated and rude towards you. They oftentimes don't perceive it as very fun either, you know. So in fairness, they may find that contact to be fairly aversive as well. But it's tempting to kind of think like, well, what the hell happened to my kid? You know, they were this like nice little 11-year-old, you know, who would do what I say most often eventually, you know, and now like they're, it doesn't matter what I do. I have no power anymore. You know, who's to blame? And that's where the video games come in.
It can be a problem of attribution, really, is kind of what I hear you saying, because often our boys' interest in video games kind of ramps up around that age. You know, for one, they've got the hand-eye coordination, their friends are doing it. And so video game play becomes more intense and more common around 11, 12, 13 than say at four, as we mentioned. Yeah. So it's easy to attribute those changes. Well, he's rude. He never talked to me like this before. Some of it is development that may have happened anyway. And Janet, referring to your earlier point about the pandemic, I worry a little bit about that too. I see people referencing these changes that have happened in their kids and blaming it on the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And certainly the pandemic hasn't helped so many things. We all know that. But your kids were going to grow anyway. Your kids were going to go through tough times anyway. Mm-hmm. And so some of it's age, some of it's growing, and sure, some of it's pandemic. And maybe some is technology.
Yeah, it's a complicated mixture. So one of the things that's sort of interesting in one of the studies we had done, and this is where I say, like, you know, it's parents kind of want to shift the blame as much as possible. And I'm not trying to like blame parents for like everything either. But in one of the studies we did with Korean kids, so this is in a Korean context, in fairness, what we found is we were looking at sort of like what caused kids to eventually develop these kind of like pathological patterns in terms of their gaming. One of the things we found was it wasn't so much time spent gaming. So it's not like if you spent a lot of time gaming at one time period that later you developed into, you know, pathological patterns of behavior. There's a little bit of a correlation there, but it wasn't very big. Smaller than most people with, but really the big predictors was like parenting style and also interactions with the educational system. And what tended to happen is you had, again, it's a very Korean context, South Korea, and you had kids who were stressed because their parents were putting a lot of stress on them and their academic institutions were putting a lot of stress on them. And they dealt with that stress by turning more and more to video games. That's the kind of the thing we see a lot is that it's oftentimes a sort of larger constellation of social stress that is leading to for these boys, you know, to move into more and more gaming related behaviors. But that's a tough message to get across to parents. It's like, hey, sometimes it actually is you're not interacting with your kid very well, you know, and that may be causing the stress that's leading them to retreat further and further into a video game universe rather than interacting with the family. I hear that from parents a lot. It's like, you know, I used to spend a lot of time with my kid. Now my kid doesn't want to spend any time with me anymore. They want to play video games all the time. Why is that? You know, and the answer is kind of like, well, you might be an asshole to some extent. You know what I mean? You know, it might be you. I mean, no, I'm exaggerating that a little bit. You know, parents, of course, range in terms of their quality, but how you're interacting with your kid, even if it's in good faith, I should, you know, say what I said, but even if it is in good faith, may not be what they need, you know, right
yeah.
now. And you may be sort of forcing what you think they should do onto them, and that is causing them stress right at the developmental period where they are trying to pull away, you know, and establish more autonomy, which is kind of a challenge for adolescents and particularly for boys.
And it's back to what you said about you're parenting a different child in this next stage of development. And I work with families all the time with parents in my coaching practice. And there is that place of like, okay, now you need to shift into being more collaborative, being less authoritative and top-down kind of parenting. It is a shift and parents don't know about it. There's not a manual. Actually, there is a manual because Jen just wrote the book. I'm going to just put a plug in here for her book, The First Time Mom's Guide to Raising Boys. And that is the reference point of how to shift and parent these tweens and teens that are different altogether.
Yeah.
So the biggest takeaway I'm hearing so far, you know, ultimately as a parent in the end, I don't care if we call it video game addiction. I don't care if we call it pathological gaming. I just want my kid to get up, do the things he's supposed to do, put in at least decent effort at school and be a decent person. And my perception is gaming is the problem. But based on what I've heard you say so far, probably the worst thing that parents can do is to start like hammering on the gaming and the game time, because even if the parent is only or maybe a part of this, me yelling at my kid and blaming the game and why do you just want to play games all the time, that's probably not going to help, is it?
No, it's definitely not. There's this weird thing that happens to, I think, most adults. It's like there's like a part of our brains that remember what it's like to be a teenager that seems to die like around age 25 or something of that sort. So when we have kids, we forget what it's like to be, you know, at very least a teenager in particular. So, I mean, I get these comments, like one of my favorite comments I ever got from a father, and it's not even thinking like, well, fathers ought to know boys because they were boys, you know, whatever. It's like you kind of say, well, maybe moms don't understand the appeal of like violent video games because they were never attracted to that sort of stuff. But fathers, I don't know, because they watch war movies and, you know, that kind of stuff,
right.
You know, cops and robbers or whatever. But no, one of my favorite comments was from a father, and he said something like, why won't my kid spend as much time or attention on his homework as he does on his video games? I was like, Do you remember being a teen? Did you spend a lot of time on your homework? Did you enjoy? When in history were teenagers ever like what you're describing? I get a lot of the stuff about like looking at trees too. I want my kid to be outside looking at, I don't know when teenagers ever looked at trees. I don't think this was ever a thing. But there's this kind of like this utopian ideal of what teenagers should do that no generation of teenagers has ever done, you know? So I don't think there's anything like unique about like this video game generation in terms of like not liking homework and not wanting to do it or not wanting to do chores or being rebellious towards their parents. If you look at like Plato's dialogues, he's complaining, or at least he has these ancient Athenians complaining about the same stuff 2,500 years ago. So this seems to be a fairly consistent sort of phenomenon. You can put limits on time. It's easy if you'd been doing that all along since they were, like, so if you try to introduce it when they're older, they'll see it as a regression, you know, as opposed to sure. a consistent pattern, which would be harder, you know, to do. But usually what you want to do is kind of like, as we say in psychology, reward low base rate behavior with high base rate behavior, right? Which basically say, make them do the homework first and then reward them with screen time, you know, that sort of stuff. Rather than trying to do it the other way around or letting them be freeform. You know, if you kind of have the rules around like you have to do an hour of homework and then you get like 2 hours of screen time, whatever you want, but and keep going back and forth, that's fine to sort of put those things in place. If you start indulging moral panics, though, about like, this is like heroin, you know, or violent video games will make you a school shooter or something like that, you're going to sound ridiculous. You will lose credibility, you know, with those teenagers. And the things you have to try to remember is like, try to remember when you were a teenager and you liked some form of media or technology and your parents said stuff about that. Like if you keep listening to Prince, you're becoming a Satanist or something like that. And remember how ridiculous that sounded when your parents said stuff like that. And I picked on Prince specifically because in these congressional hearings in the 80s, he was one of the artists that, you know, the U.S. Congress thought, you know, him, Cyndi Lauper, AC/DC, all these like 80s bands, thought were corrupting youth, you know, back then. Nobody thinks Prince or Cyndi Lauper contributing to like Satanism or violence or teen sex or things like that, you know, today. So back then, that's when I was a teenager. I remember adults, you know, saying this stuff. They sound like idiots because they were idiots, you know.
You know what? I was preparing for this yesterday and I was driving and it was the nighttime show on the radio and Alice Cooper hosts a classic rock show. Mm-hmm. And anybody who, you know, grew up in the 70s or 80s, you may know Alice Cooper as like, he scared me when I was a kid. Like he was freaky and like death and guillotines and bloody babies and like not the kind of thing that most parents would say, I am so glad that my child is listening to Alice Cooper. Not that kind of thing at all. But he was reading a letter from a listener who said, hey, your album, Nightmare or something. I'm not a huge Alice Cooper fan.
Probably Welcome to My Nightmare.
Welcome to My Nightmare. That was it. I was in a terrible situation. I was a teenager. My mother was so abusive. I was literally planning to murder her. Mm-hmm. I was planning to murder her. And there was something about this album that touched me. And I listened to it over and over and I processed it. And ultimately I did not kill my mother. And I'm so glad. And it made me think about this because I know you've researched, for instance, violence in video games. It's easy for adults to think you hear this music and you're going to do something terrible. You play this violent video game and you're going to become violent. And we think we see this in our house. Like my kid is all amped up and you ought to hear the things he's playing when his team loses on Fortnite. The research doesn't prove any kind of a causative link there, does it?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, you know, of course, it's kind of, I mean, I like your example of Alice Cooper because I like some of his music, but that guy sang about necrophilia. I mean, of course, all a big joke, you know, it's all, he also went on the Muppets, which is sort of weird as a combination, but he sang about all these like crazy, you know, things. He still guillotines himself on stage and all kinds of other stuff. I saw him a few years ago. He's fantastic. But then they see him today. He's like golfs with those like checkered white and green pants and stuff. It's like, he's like 107 years old. You know, it's like, you know, nobody thinks that he's like, you know, the porthole to, you know, hell or anything. today. Of course, the average age of his audience is like 94. but that sort of points out like this generational nature of this stuff is that, you know, it's something that old people worry about. And I'm increasingly becoming an old people too. You know, we tend to worry about whatever the new technology and new media is. And that creates this audience for a moral panic, which newspapers and politicians and even scholars to some extent cater to. And then their audience dies. You know, that basically, you know, the people that worried about Prince and Cyndi Lauper and Alice Cooper and AC/DC are dead. You know, so now it's people that grew up with that are now in power. Now we worry about smartphones and video games. To go back to your question, there's no evidence to suggest that, you know, playing Call of Duty or, you know, Grand Theft Auto, even as a pre-17 adolescent male, is associated with any form of violence. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, we all need to run out and get Grand Theft Auto 5 for our kids. You know, it's got, you know, content in there that's, you know, intended for adults to be sure. But you can make that decision on moral grounds that you just don't feel comfortable. There's nothing wrong with making that decision, but it's not going to turn your kid into like a rapist or mass killer or something of that sort. There's just no evidence to suggest that.
So that's along the lines of violence. Let's talk about how women are represented in mm-hmm. video games and how that may influence how our boys think about girls and women.
Yeah, same thing. Basically, there's not any evidence to suggest as much impact on playing what we call sexualized games, you know, mm-hmm. On male attitudes towards women, or for that matter, female attitudes towards women, or body image, or things like that. Games have gotten much better in general, too. I mean, you can still find your Grand Theft Auto 5s and stuff, but a lot of games, it became a real cultural thing to try to shift into having more positive representations of women or female characters of all sorts in video games. So you can see, like, from 10 years ago, there's been a pretty big shift in terms of having at least a wider range of representations. But, you know, of course, historically, you know, games, this is all blamed on Nintendo for the most part, by the way, who are not known for particularly sexualizing games. But, you know, games going way back to the early 90s with the NES were marketed mainly towards boys, you know, mm-hmm. so they were, you know, they were a toy. They were considered a toy at the time. Nobody thinks of them as a toy now, but they're considered a toy. And they had to decide, do you market it on the boy side of the toy store or the girl side of the toy store? You know, so they decided to go with the boy side. That meant that they had to market all these games towards boys. And of course, what adolescent boys want more than anything is naked women. It's just, they were catering to that audience, you know, basically. Mm-hmm. And so they had a lot of highly sexualized female representations, because that's what particularly adolescent boys like, you know, mm-hmm. was a lot of games. Eventually, more and more girls and women started playing. So the audience kind of broadened out. Games got more sophisticated. You know, there was this kind of advocacy push towards, you know, increasing things. But yeah, if you look at studies of, like, you know, whether they're correlational or experimental, we've done one experimental study at Stetson with women. We're doing one right now with men. And generally what you find is that same thing, is that our attitudes don't seem to be shaped very much by fictional media. At very least, or our behaviors don't seem to be. There's something about knowing that the thing is fictional, even as kids, that seems to limit its impact on how we perceive the quote unquote real world, you know, around us. And that's something that's different from like news media, or maybe even social media, which, you know, sometimes seems true-ish, you know, if mm-hmm. you will. Mm-hmm.
So what I hear you saying is that as a parent, what is going on in the real world? The non-digital world. And I don't even like making that distinction anymore, because the digital world is part of a real world. But the human interactions that I am having with my child, and the other interactions that my child are having with other humans, friends, family members, people at school, that all matters more than what is in the game, what games he's playing. Mm-hmm. And if I want to foster good outcomes, I would probably be better off putting my energy towards those interactions with my kid than worrying too much about the gaming.
Absolutely. I mean, even perhaps the more nihilistic version of this is to say that the biggest chunk of a child's behavior is genetic, which means that the biggest contribution you could have made was choosing a partner who had good genes, in essence.
banging my head against the microphone as I'm sure many of our listeners who are going, oh, I should have thought that through a little bit more.
Not much we can do about that, you know, at this point, for the most part. Hopefully we chose well. I know I've been happily married for almost 20 years at this point, so I chose well. So,
yay for you.
Actually, you'd be surprised how like little impact parenting in general has on child development in a way. So what you want to do as parents is set up a generally warm, loving place where kids feel safe. That's kind of like the big thing you can do as parents. Other than that, whatever you do, it doesn't really matter. You can be a tiger mom. You can be a free range mom, whatever. I don't know. There's probably like dozens of these versions of best-selling books that try to sell you on. You can pick one. It doesn't matter. You know, like sure. just don't abuse your kid. Don't neglect them. Make sure they feel loved. Feed them. You know, simple stuff for the most part. Other than that, you know, most of the others, even like stuff like this contrary, like spanking doesn't really seem to have much impact, whether you do or you don't. You know, these are all largely, you know, non-relevant factors to child's development. But what happens is, you know, you have the chance for 12 years to set up this generally safe, warm, loving environment that will help will allow the child to grow maximally. And that goes for about 12 years. And then you lose almost all influence whatsoever at about the time puberty kicks in which case peers become somewhat more influential at that point. So kids will tend to shift their sort of source of reference or safety even from parents. Now you still want to have that safe environment, but you know, now they're more interested in what their peers are doing. And you know, it's kind of a period of maximum conformity, if you will, as they try to fit in and develop their social identities within their peer group. And that lasts through early to mid 20s. And then you just become old people, you know, and your brain starts to fall apart and you know, who knows what the hell you're going to do from one day to another. So
Chris, I think your next book needs to be just like, you know, simplifying parenting, because you just kind of pretty much laid it out pretty simply and basically there. I'm still thinking about the listeners, and as we wrap up, I'm thinking about the moms, because a lot of times it is the moms out there that are still on the other side of the bedroom door, just longing to have some interaction with their son, feeling sad, feeling frustrated, feeling angry about the prevalence of video games in their son's life, and what can you offer them? I'm always about practical strategies. How do they get their boy out of their room? And, you know, they may not have limited time, like you have said. And they're, as women tend to do, we catastrophize into the future. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's going to be a failure and he's going to be in his bedroom until he's 35. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we have this rolling picture of how awful this is going to be. Can you offer those mamas some hope?
Yes and no. So
okay. in the long
term, yes. In the short term, no. So if it's mom's goal is to like get the kid out of the bedroom and like go hand in hand, you know, at the zoo looking at all the critters, that's not going to happen. In fact, it's developmentally not appropriate.
Sure.
You give it a decade. I think it was the old cliche joke is, you know, when I was a teenager, I, you know, came to understand how foolish and unintelligent my parents were. And then by the time I was in my mid-20s, I was surprised to find out how much they'd learned in the intervening decade.
How smart they'd gotten. So
what tends to happen, especially for boys, and also for girls though, but they have a somewhat different trajectory, but boys, more even than girls, tend to detach from their parents in the adolescent years. And that's kind of a developmentally normal period. So your kid not having any interest in spending time with you is normal. Mm-hmm. It's sad. I get it. My wife has expressed some of this to me. So it's common. It's universal. It is developmentally appropriate for your teenage son to not want to spend time with you. They might occasionally, you know, condescend to spend a little bit of time, but you are, you know, I mean, all moms and dads are an embarrassment to them because they are trying to deny the fact they have parents at all among their peer groups. And that is how they establish, you know, what they're doing is, you know, particularly for males, is trying to establish sort of their place in the dominance hierarchy among other same age males. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being in a child role is not helpful or conducive.
You know, I think about this, maybe that part of my brain didn't fully die, or maybe it's rejuvenated a little bit. But, you know, even when I'm like, okay, I just want a little bit of time, like out of the month, I'm not talking every day. Like, could we have like one day when we're all at home and maybe we spend time together? Yeah. And then I remember when I was a teenager, and obviously I'm female, but when I was a teenager, it never crossed my mind to plan in time with my parents. Are you kidding me? Like, I was thinking about my job. I was thinking about school. I was thinking about my friends. Yeah. My family was nothing but an obstacle to me at that point in my life. From my perspective, obviously now I can recognize that they were the scaffolding that allowed me to focus on all those other things, right. But I didn't know that when I was a teenager.
Yeah, absolutely. The parents exist as food dispensary mechanisms, you know, essentially what they're there for.
Every now and then, a ride. If you can lure your ride, boy into the car, you might have a little conversation.
With food.
But not a ride directly to anywhere where their peers might be. Yeah, they'd be dropped off like a block away or something like that. That's how they walked. You know, or, you know, I don't know, somehow got there by magic, you know, transporter or something like that, like out of Star Trek. Yeah, I mean, the one thing you can try to do is, you know, find out what the youth is interested in and meet them there. So you can bribe them with like a horror movie and pizza sometimes, you know, if they're not otherwise occupied. It will be a point where they're not otherwise occupied. So if they're just having a Saturday where, you know, they just didn't connect with their friends, that's the time to say, wait, hey, you're home anyway. You know, why don't we get a pizza and we'll watch, you know, Friday the 13th or something of that sort, or whatever, you know, Prometheus or whatever. And even if you're like blanching at every scene because it's not your thing, that's what you have to do. In order to try to, you know, you have to meet them pretty much on their ground almost entirely, because they're not going to come to meet you on your ground, because it's just not incentive structure to do that. But developmentally, what seems to happen is somewhere by the mid-20s, then males and females as well, but particularly males, then kind of come back to the family. But they do so sort of with a sense of having established their position with their peers. And they oftentimes will sort of treat their parents almost like friends at that point, you know, that the parental relationship is still gone, you know, but now that they're basically, they say like, now that we all understand that you have no power over me, now we can hang out again. I'm no longer really embarrassed by you, at least because I'm confident now in my adult role. Now you do see some males, which are the ones I think that, you know, probably the parents are most worried about, who are sort of like late bloomers, I guess, would be sort of like the what happens. You do find some guys who, and this seems to be increasingly common for teenagers of both sexes. But, you know, it's funny because like 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, most scholars worried about teens having too much sex. Surprisingly, scholars now worry about teens having not enough sex. You know, you can't win, you know, with this stuff. But I think that's an interesting sort of shift. But that is true. Teens are having less and less sex. Even young adults are having less and less sex over time. And so you do find this cadre of males who are a little bit less socially competent. They're more socially awkward. They, you know, they don't have as many friends. They're not good with girls or boys if they're gay. They may not be that, they don't know what they're going to do with their lives. They're not that motivated towards college. They're not that motivated towards jobs or that kind of stuff. So yeah, they kind of just sit in, you know, in their bedroom or basement or whatever, and they play video games. So that's fun. They just don't know what they're going to do. And so for a lot of those guys, I'm not going to say this, everything's always rosy and you shouldn't worry about them at all. But a lot of these guys kind of in their like early to mid 20s, kind of like snap to, if you will, and they realize this is kind of lame. And so then they kind of start to build the platforming for other kinds of stuff. So don't lose hope. It's kind of, you know, again, don't ignore the problem and say, oh, well, it'll just go away with time. But also don't lose hope. There are this cadre of boys that, you know, they're not going to be the superstar high school athlete with lots of girls, you know, or a good part-time job. They will just seem to be unmotivated and unsure of themselves. But oftentimes they kind of like come together in their early to mid 20s. You know, again, that's later than most of us would want. But usually things work out okay for them. They just take a little longer to get there.
I think that's fair to point out that has always existed as well. You're talking and I hear my husband in that completely and totally. Now, he's old enough that like video games weren't a thing when he was a young teenager. So trust me, he found plenty of other ways to occupy his time that weren't what most parents would consider a productive use of his time, right? Mm-hmm. And that lasted until about his mid-20s, at which point there was a part of him that was like, huh, mm-hmm. not really going anywhere or doing anything. And, you know, in his 50s, he is a perfectly caring husband, father, contributing member of the society. His parents did so much hand-wringing, you know, like so much, and he turned out to be an okay person. So what you said is so valuable, a reminder that yes, it's okay to worry. Yes, it's okay to ask questions, seek help, get advice, but just don't lose hope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there isn't like a magic bullet. I mean, I think that's a lot that happens with parents is they think of like, there must be something I'm not doing.
Yes.
You know, that somehow there's the other parents have this magic trick that they've done with their 17-year-old boys or 18-year-old boys or whatever, and made them into superstar athletes and college students, you know, material, all this kind of, where my kids are sort of sitting in the base. What did I do that they didn't do? Oftentimes the answer is nothing. They just got a different set of genes than your kid did, you know? And there isn't, I can say, as a psychologist, there is no magic bullet, you know, that particularly if a person is in their mid-teens to early 20s, another human being has almost no control over their behavior. There is nothing you can do to force them, you know, other than like kick them out of the house, or which is kind of extreme and not guaranteed to be very helpful. Putting incentive structures in place by that point, they're pretty resistant to it. Embrace the helplessness to some extent and, you know, continue to provide that, you know, loving and warm encouragement as best you can. You can maybe try putting a few things in place, like saying like, you know, well, once you hit 18, I'm not going to pay for your cell phone anymore. You need to get a job. You want to have a cell phone. You can do some small stuff like that and, you know, be ready for some anger to come back your way. But in general, you know, you'd want to still provide that warm environment with gentle encouragement for the person to move forward with their lives. But also for your own mental health, realize that the truth is that you don't have that much control over another human being who's an adult or close to being an adult at that point, you know.
Okay, so I want, just like Janet, let's give people something to do, okay? So I'm a parent, I'm listening, I'm like, yeah, okay, Chris, that all sounds really good, but I'm worried about my kid and his gaming. What's step one, step two, and step three? What should I do?
Yeah, step one is to realize you're probably wrong. And the way to figure that out is to ask yourself seriously, why are you concerned? Are you concerned because the child's grades are slipping, that they are not sleeping at least, you know, 7-8 hours of sleep a night, they're not exercising at least half an hour to an hour a day, and they seem unhappy? Those are really the four things to look for. You know, are their grades slipping? Are they not sleeping? Are they not exercising? And do they seem unhappy? If you say no to all four of those, there is no problem. It's not a diagnosable thing. The problem is with you, that you are simply not valuing, you know, what your child is choosing to do with their spare time, you know, which is again, sort of.
Okay. Now let's say there's yeses to some of those.
So if you say yes to some of those, you know, first off, it still might not be the video game that's causing the problem. They may have insomnia because they're stressed at school. And so while they're awake anyway, so they might as well play the video game, you know, that kind of stuff. So realize it still might not be the technology that's the root cause, but you shouldn't ignore it. So this is where, you know, sometimes technology overuse can be a red flag, you know, or a symptom of something that's going on. So what I've seen clinically is really like 90% of families fit into one situation, which is that, and it does tend to be boys, but it's not always, sometimes it's girls too. But a child is playing more, you know, video games than they should, and they are neglecting, usually it's homework. They're neglecting their homework. Usually they worry about. Sometimes the parents are concerned about chores not getting done too. I don't hear as much about the sleep or friends or happiness. It's usually the homework or the, occasionally I do, but it's mostly the homework or chores. In which case you could do that, what I was referring to before, the sort of rewarding low base rate behaviors with high base rate behaviors. So basically say, you know, come and talk to the child or get a therapist involved. And sometimes kids will, you know, when they're in a more neutral environment, they'll acknowledge something's a bigger problem than they would to just their parents. And you might just say, work out, well, how about we do this? We do like an hour, or you might work with a kid. Like, how long can you concentrate, you know, at a given time period? You know, 20 minutes. Okay. So you do 20 minutes of homework and then do a half an hour of video games. then set a timer, you know, and do 20 minutes of homework and then half an hour of video games. You just keep that pattern going until the homework is done. You know, it depends on what any particular child. I say that because I kind of have ADD issues, as you probably can tell from the way I talk. But, you know, so different kids are going to be able to concentrate for different lengths of time. So you just got to figure out what works in terms of rewards, you know, rewarding the behavior you want them to do with the behavior they want to do, and just keep that pattern working for you. That clears up about 90% of cases, I would say. The other 10% are going to need, you know, there's really something bigger going on. You know, they may be depressed, they may be anxious, they may be autism spectrum disordered individuals. So there's a bigger mental health issue that's happening. In which case, you know, then I would definitely, even in the 90%, you might want to seek, you know, professional help, but definitely in that last 10%, if that's not working, then to seek. And what I usually would say is to look for a psychologist or psychiatrist who specializes in teens. Not one of these clinics that you Googled they get the first hit. Because some of these places will charge you $30,000 a month for like inpatient treatment that has no evidence that it works. You know, so there's a lot of caveat emptor, you know, in that facility. And so if you have insurance, you know, friends, you are going to get perfectly good treatment. You might have to shop around a little bit to find the right therapist, but you will get perfectly fine treatment with your insurance plans coverage for a outpatient psychiatrist or psychologist to address whatever underlying issues that the child may be experiencing, which is, and it's probably gone. Well, I mean, near 100%, it's going to be that there's something else that's going on that you may not be aware of, you know, you may or may not be aware of, but they may be experiencing more significant mental health problems that they're not feeling comfortable expressing to you, which is very common. Doesn't mean you did anything wrong. They're teenagers. And that might be the thing that is alerting you that they're stressed, they're depressed, something else is really major that's going on, and they're just using the video games or other technology like smartphones to entertain themselves or make themselves feel better from that. But
I hear so much hope here, and I hope that our listeners do as well. I have a feeling that many of you, like me, are going to want to listen to this episode more than once because there's layers here. I mean, layer number one, parenting can be way simpler than we make it. Teenagers are teenagers. That's just a thing. It's going to be a thing. We'll touch base again when they're in their 20s, and video games are probably not the problem. Trust your instincts, trust your connection with your kid, build your connection with your kid, but also let him go and do his thing when he needs to do his thing. Chris, I still point a lot of people to your book, Moral Combat. What is the full name of it again?
Moral Combat, Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong.
And are you working on another book? Are there other places where people can go if they want to learn more about you and your work?
Sure. They can go to my website, which is just my name. It's not very original. It's www.christopherjferguson.com. I have also recently written another book, How Madness Shaped History, which is kind of what it says on the box, essentially. Intersection of psychology and history, focusing on all the negative stuff, of course, all the, you know, sort of really crazy people in history. And I'm working on one now, basically psychology of catastrophe and how, like, when bad things happen, how human psychology tends to make them worse. Basically. So as you can see, I kind of have a negative bent.
You're a perky guy, aren't you?
The dark side, Chris. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your wealth of knowledge around child development and video games in this case, but sounds like you have many other aspects that are quite interesting as well.
I'm going to put all of this in the show notes. I encourage anybody who has questions or comments to leave it on our website. Hit us up on social media. We love to hear what your experiences are with gaming and parenting. And if you have any extra questions for Chris, let us know and we will see if we can get him to answer them for us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
This was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on today.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation about not only video games, but boy development, typical boy development. We know that boys can feel like a puzzle, like a mystery sometimes, and we have resources for you. Go to my website, boysalive.com, and opt in for my free guide, Boys and Big Emotions, Common Mistakes Parents Make and What to Do Instead. And you also want to go to Jen's website, buildingboys.net, and subscribe to her Building Boys Bulletin. It is a wealth of resources, articles that she has curated. It's a quick way to really see what our boys are up against and how we can support them to be their best. Thanks for being an On Boys listener. If you liked this podcast, tell a friend. Thank you.